This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at Zen Mountain Monastery. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. This is a poem by Pablo Neruda, one of my favorites, called Keeping Quiet. Now we will count to 12, and we will all keep still. For once on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment, without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the man gathering salt would not look at his hurt hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their companions in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it is about. I want no trunk with death. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of our threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us when everything seems dead and later proves to be alive. Now I'll count to 12, and you keep quiet, and I will go. So we had a retreat this weekend that Shoan and Gokhan led on the still point and how stillness functions into our active lives. How does stillness move? And also the week before, I was in the Adirondacks with a group of women, not 10 of us total. Which was called the Call to the Forest, Circles on the Water, where we were making contact with the ancestors, both of the land, who was there before us, the spirits of rocks, mountains, waters, those ancestors, and our women ancestors, and kind of feeling what it might have been like to practice moving in the forest into different areas to get and in silence so we could really feel space and listen for calls. So I thought this came to mind. Pablo Neruda, many of you may know him, lived from 1904 to 1973. I'm not going to say a lot about his life. You can look him up. But he was a Nobel Prize-winning Chilean poet, diplomat, politician, and many things within that. And he began writing as a young teen, so he heard the call from silence at a very young age. And the part that I loved was he always wrote in green ink, which I didn't know, which for him symbolized solidarity, love, healing, breathing in goodness. And we had these moments in the forest where we were like sudden strangers, an exoticness in the moment, as he writes. Let me keep that forward. So he asks us to slow down, to be in each other's presence in the face of a whirlwind of activity. How do we do that? How do we slow down so we can feel the presence and step out of the whirlwind of activity that often overtakes our lives. And he speaks of the need for peace and silence, being quiet, being harmless to the earth, to the environment, to animals, to each other. And he's giving us a big reminder to break the momentum of busyness that fuels our sadness of never really understanding ourselves, that we do need that time to do that, to quiet down, stop the momentum of busyness, of never feeling how suffering, how our pain can bring us closer to our hearts, to the hearts of others. To loneliness, to fear, to love, is to feel loss and grief, to feel it. But on some level, we don't really want this sometimes. There's a zillion things that we can do to keep ourselves going from actually, that's there, it's already here. Pain is here. It's like it's, joy is here, all things are here. But that's not something we particularly want to touch or acknowledge or bring in or meet. So we have an evening gatha. Let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance, and that time swiftly passes by. Our opportunities are lost. Each of us should strive to awaken. Awaken, take heed. Don't squander your life. Dogen wrote in a fascicle called Time Being, do not think that time merely flies away. Do not think that time merely flies away. Do not see flying away as the only function of time. If time merely flies away, you would be separated from time. The reason you do not clearly understand the time being is that you think of time only as passing. He's saying time is existence. Your time right now, being time, if you're being time. I don't know where you are, but how do you be time? How do you not waste time? We aren't static things that move through time. We are time itself. So do we ever really take the time to ask ourselves, what do we really want? What are we here for? I'm talking about real time. Because even in a monastery or a day like this, we might not ask or be time, which is weird. I mean, if we truly believe we're part of a larger spiritual reality that can offer us peace and happiness and empower us to make the world healthier and happier, why don't we enthusiastically embrace every practice that might help us enter into that reality? I found this quote by George Bernard Shaw. He wrote, "What the true joy of life lies in being devoted to." He says, being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world were not devote itself to making you happy. So I'm not calling on anyone here a little clod of anything. I'm just saying, think about it. Are you too busy to do nothing? Are you too busy to do nothing? Which, rather than being nothing, might actually mean everything to our happiness. So thank you, George. So many people that I speak to, and you might too, speak about busyness. People even tell me, I'm too busy. Like, I'm here, and they're saying, you must be too busy. And I'm like, wow. That there's no time to do this or to do that. Or how quickly. So that was a good line, wasn't it? No time to do this or that. How quickly things are moving. And the monastics talk about it all the time. How are we doing? What is all this combustion about? How are we using our time? Are we being time? What kinds of efforts are we making? And what kinds of resources are needed to do it? How are we taking care? Do not think that time merely flies away. When we're full of our schedules, full of our to-do lists and our busyness, our life is flying by. We do not have time to drop down and feel the moment. And this inability to feel whole in our moments is why our life feels dissatisfying. No? Right? For me, it is. It's a partial moment, and then we move on to the next thing. And that was one thing that the wilderness can bring to you, is that settlement more deeply. Do not see flying away as the only function of time. So we run around, but what are we experiencing? If time merely flies away, you'd be separated from time. Do we try, as we're taught by the Buddha, to do what we're doing, and teachers, do what you're doing while you're doing, it? And that could seem like nothing to most observers. That practice, do what you're doing while you're doing it, might seem like absolutely nothing. But little do they know what that includes. So even if what we're doing is being distracted, not wanting to be sitting or working, can we do just that? Can we do just distraction? How do you do that? Be nothing other than what we are. Whatever that moment of our makeup, whatever that makeup of our moment is. If the clear mind comes, let it come. If the clouds appear, let it appear. Do we try and change the sky? What happens if we try and not want this heat? Watch your temperature go up. Then we're not killing time. We're actually making it come alive if we can be who we are. But we're not wired this way. We're wired for future accomplishment. It's a powerful habit, and it's this always striving to be other than what we have right now. Sometimes in huge ways, and sometimes in, you gotta be, it's so subtle. It's so subtle how we don't want to be what we are in this moment. And the habit is that even when we reach our goal, we'll still be driven by that habit to look for the next thing. We have this essay in the Mountain Record. I'll just read you, Janet Roofing, on the demon of busyness. She wrote this great, you should read all of it, Resisting the Demon of Busyness. She's teaches at Yale in the, you know her? Yeah. And she wrote, she's a professor of spirituality. She said, resting the demon of busyness requires choices we would prefer not to make. And if we should succeed in making them, I guarantee they will go unrewarded in both the secular and religious cultures in which we participate. If we're honest, we admit to ourselves that there is something about this busyness that we love. I like to be busy. We like it in this way, despite our half-hearted protests to the contrary. If we're as busy as we pretend to be, then we're too busy to allow ourselves to be affected by the pain and suffering of our world. We're too busy to be addressed personally by the social, political, or ecological disasters occurring in our relationships. We're too busy to listen to our own feelings and those of others. Our busyness insulates from care and from compassion. Our busyness deadens our feelings and numbs our responses. The expectation that we must be busy all the time feels as if it is an external expectation, with the result that we don't recognize that is also self-generated in collusion with the culture. I become flighty with so many things to attend to, moving from one thing to another, sometimes intuitively, sometimes impulsively, and sometimes unreflectively. By this time, I am divided by my consciousness. It requires a different kind of discipline not to allow my attention to get caught in these ways. This divided, distracted consciousness is a large part of the demon of busyness. This state of consciousness is literally illusion. It is something our collective consciousness keeps going because we agree to it. By keeping it going, getting captured by it, I fail to ask myself, what do I really want? I collude in frustrating my deepest desires, my pleasure, I added, by indulging the demon of busyness so that I never have to ask what I really want to do or really need to do. Where I do so, I might make a difference, a different set of choices in response to it. We need to resist in the sense of time, urgency, and all the internal diffusion of consciousness which simultaneously thinks of the future, basks in self-importance, and maintains an illusion of control. All of those internal thoughts actually divert us from all dimensions of present reality. They are literally useless and exhausting, yet somehow we love them. There's a lot in there. It's a long essay. And that's, Neruda's got that all in his poem as well. So the best way I know how to learn how to not waste time is to practice not wasting time. Every time I revow to try and fully experience what I'm in, what comes my way. It's a concentration practice. You've learned it. It's a mindfulness practice. Not to try to change it, but to just do what I'm doing. The reason you do not clearly understand the time being is that you think of time as only as passing. So Buddha called this the second noble truth, dukkha. I'll paraphrase. If we can learn about being time, we can enter into a place of satiation of being as time. We can touch the eternal source daily in our ordinary tasks by being time. So is it possible to be busy and free? Can we be busy and free? When does our busyness obstruct our freedom and make us suffer? What is the nectar for those parts of ourself that are dissatisfied and crying out for clarity? So this was, I went back into my notes and I did find this story about an interview with a CEO from Disney that was in the Times, which I love. So it's called My Quiet Time. Listen to this. Whoever said that the early bird gets the worm could have been talking about me. I'm a person, not a bird, and I'm interested in getting worms, more like getting things done. But I do get up early. In fact, the secret to my success could be boiled down to three little words. My quiet time. It begins at 1 a.m. when I get out of bed, check my email, brush my teeth, scan some documents, and floss. Then I'll surf the web. Maybe order a sectional couch or trade zloty futures. Last week, I bought a Swiss chalet and sold it at 20% profit while I was still in my pajamas. I wanted to high-five someone, but no one was up yet. Sometimes I can't remember if I've flossed already, so I'll do it again, just to be sure, while checking my email and maybe send a fax. Did I mention that the early bird gets the worm? So we may find ourselves in that in some way. He goes on a little bit longer. So when I speak to people about practice, and maybe you brought it up in this weekend, and particularly about sitting practice, they tell me how fast things are moving and how so many things need to be taken care of. And they're barely able to keep up. You know how it is, they say. Life gets in the way. And people speak about Zazen and their life and how difficult it is to sit down at home. And I know this. I've practiced from my home. And when they do take time, they feel guilty, anxious, and restless, taking time to just sit. Because it feels like a worthless activity. Out comes the measuring rod to something we can't see. We can't see the depths of what happens when we sit down into stillness and how that ripples out. That is not visible. It touches again on this worthiness of our culture, not producing. What is Zazen worth? Do you hear yourself say it? I do. I barely have time to catch my breath. Or is it that we didn't think we could or know how to? That we could actually take a moment to orient and ground ourselves in our body. Anywhere, that we actually can do that. Feel our breath. Literally, we forget we're breathing. So it is knowing, remembering that we're breathing, and that we need to lengthen that and guard that as a practitioner. And we all know there are situations that take our breath away. But if you didn't have it keep going, you wouldn't be sitting upright right now. And we also know we can be plugged in 24/7 to something. Even as a monastic. Our life is by no means cloistered. We're online. So I watch this busyness play out carefully. I practice it. There's no activity that can't be summoned from the outside now. I mean, where people find people, like they have people on the top of Mount Everest, like being found on some communication. We can be anywhere, bathroom, garden, car, we're found. Something can get to us. And it's what we value. And it doesn't always feel so good. Yesterday, Gaylin Godwin Roshi came, and she said, if I understood it correctly, that in France, the younger generation before Gen X, like one of those other YZs. They're actually starting to go to Zen monasteries because they're getting it that they need to get off. They need to disconnect. So they're seeing a rising in the monasteries in France. And she says, maybe it'll catch on and come to America. That's interesting. Neruda, Dogen, Buddha, so many wise ones point out how to break the momentum of fueling the busyness that fuels that sadness of never understanding ourselves. Buddha said, to follow this path and experience liberation, we first have to see things in the proper way. We have to think in the proper way. What is the proper way? He says we're topsy-turvy. We upside down. And even in his time, which we brought up on the retreat, when there was very low tech, he told his followers, his disciples, when there's no flickering devices, seek out a quiet place to do your formal practice. Protect noble silence. Be still and then move. Still and then be an activist. See properly. What do we see? What do we see? We see who we are. We see for each one of us, that true nature. We see cause and effect more clearly. We see the perfection of each state. And this helps us to see clearly, in a relative sense, there is right and wrong, there is good and evil, and go about our tasks really carefully, really carefully. Into that activism. Janet writes, we humans are different. We have the gift, curse of self-reflection, of ego, which can drown out our true selves and keep us on the go, trying to satisfy hungers we don't even know are there. To get in touch with these hungers and decide if they are in our best interests, we need to slow down and listen. To not separate, blame, hate, but skillfully attend and care. Keep up with the pulse without feeling the despair overwhelm us. How clear and critical it is to acknowledge our pain. To hear it. And at the same time, right away, it brings us closer to our humanness, to people, to situations. So it's interesting that the Chinese character for busyness is translated as heart killing. I thought that was really like penetrating. Now I will count to 12, and we will all keep still. Dogen writes, you must learn that being time is the 12 hours of nowness. And perhaps Neruda is doing the same thing, using the hours on the clock, the 12. So we begin. For now, we will take our seat and count to 10. We'll follow the breath, our koan, be awareness itself, and we will all keep still. We will all be together in a sudden strangeness. I love that. Dido used to say, we should get all the world leaders together and give them a private session before they even talk to one another. Wouldn't that be miraculous? For once on the face of the earth, let's not speak any language. Let's stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much. I love to turn the volume off while certain people are speaking on television and watch the body. If you haven't done this, so much more is communicated than what you're hearing them say. If you just watch the language of the body and don't separate yourself, because we know it too, but just feel the parts that are covered, where the hands go, how the arms are waving. You know, what is it like when you start waving your arms too much? Either you don't want to talk about what you're talking about, or you're nervous. I was telling someone I was working with, I'm not sure if I want to see this person or not. She said, okay, just like go into your body. And I went like this, like I covered myself. And she was just like, okay, take a look. I was like, oh boy, answer for a moment. That was a while ago. To listen to the cries of the world, as Merton said in his poem on silence, be still and listen to all things burning. Sit in our life with each other, with everything, when silence is on fire. To come into our own into a temple or a monastery like this, where we asked to be still, to let go of arguments, stop waving our hands so much, judging, fault finding, an effort to make the difficult disappear. Let's not speak in any language. A unified movement among people, this would be, with no discrimination based on our embodiment, on our language, on our race, on our gender. Let us stop for a moment and not move our hands. So much violence. Let us not fight and argue. So, Zazen, we know, we're that immovable mountain, receiving, giving and receiving, pulsating with life, just letting it all move through. No use of our hands or legs, no lattes, no running away, no texting, nothing. So we need to take refuge and protect quiet time. Be still to learn how to move so our stillness can become active and function properly without me. Without me. And I was thinking, doesn't it seem bizarre that we can be sitting here completely still and may not feel like we're frittering away our time? That we can actually, that is worthy. That we can really feel that this activity is worthwhile and necessary. Dogen implores us, penetrate exhaustively each Dharma position or independent time. Each moment be undivided. Kaz says, vigorously abiding in each moment. To do this, right there, our seeking gets resolved in our being. He says, if you take care of this right now with wholeheartedness, you create good conditions for the next right now. Please take good care of this moment. So is it possible that we can be sitting Zazen and be apart from this activity? You betcha. Most definitely. Short gaps, long gaps, lifetimes of gaps. And what often brings us back consciously or unconsciously is suffering. So we bow to that. It can serve. When we take our seat, it is this unique opportunity to make good use of our suffering. Big leaps and small leaps off the wheel of samsara. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the peasant gathering salt would look at their hurt, torn hands. So I did a little research, and fishermen for Neruda said might represent hunters of all kinds. And he's asking us to recognize we're hunters. We are hunters. And many of us are blind hunters. We don't even know that we're stalking, that in some way we are aiming to kill life, take it away. Neruda saw the whales as the oppressed class of human beings because of their helplessness. Here's this beautiful, huge, incredible beauties, intelligent, were and still are sought after, disrespected, with no chance of winning the hunters that we are. We hear their cries. We have recordings of them crying in the ocean. A cry for and from the oppressed. In this quiet moment of introspection, people would stop hurting others and attempt to understand themselves and see that it is only hurting ourselves. That's the turnaround. Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories without survivors, would put on clean clothing and walk around with their companions in the shade without doing a single thing. Victory without survivors? Can you really put those two words together? What's a victory with no one surviving? Is that a victory? I don't know, that puzzles me. Victories without survivors. Do those events even go together? When have we not lost tremendous lives in the process? How can there be claim to have had a victory? You know, we just misunderstand who we are. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life alone is what matters. I want nothing to do with death. So his words shouldn't be confused with death or a state of complete dormancy. That's not what he's saying. It's not a state of inactivity, but a continued action at a slower pace. Mind is what we awaken to. The nature of mind reaches everywhere, and yet it cannot be found. It includes everything, but we cannot grasp it. To realize the self is to realize mind, and the mind is everything. It includes trees, rocks, space, and time, and it certainly includes our physical body. Daito Roshi. As long as we exist, our mind is an inseparable part of us. And as a result, we are always up and down. But it's not our body that goes up and down. It's our mind. This mind whose way of functioning we don't understand. So that's what we're coming closer to, understanding the nature of mind. After all, it is our mind. It is our mind isn't telling us what to do. Satisfaction comes from the mind if we want to be happy. We have to check the way we lead our life. Our mind is our religion. Our temple is our body. If we weren't so unanimous keeping ourselves moving, if we could do nothing for once, perhaps a great silence would interrupt this sadness, this never understanding ourselves and threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth is teaching us is when everything seems dead and then everything is alive. Dedicated doers and fixers that we are. We try to manage everything. You know, when we feel the slightest pain, do you feel yourself immediately look for the solution? We think in terms of finding solutions. And then we demonize our pain and suffering. Befriend what is actually happening. Understand. Turn toward it. Get a read out. Stop the war. Stop the hating. Doing it to ourselves. It keeps the whole thing going. Let's see where we are. Oh, I'll end soon. But I thought this was interesting. This is old, but it's called Bumping into Mr. Ravioli. It's a theory of busyness and its hero. And I'll just tell you, it's about this young girl named Olivia. This writer's writing about his daughter. And she, at 7 and a half, this peculiar thing happens with Olivia's imaginary playmate, who becomes too busy to play with her. So she holds a toy cell phone up to her ear, and then they hear her talk into it. Ravioli? It's Olivia. It's Olivia. Come and play. Okay, call me. Bye. And then she snaps it shut, and she shakes her head. I always get his machine, she says. Or she will say, I spoke to Ravioli today. Did you have fun? My wife will ask. No, he's busy working. Whew. So they were like watching this go on. And again, they would hear her say, I bumped into Charlie Ravioli today. He was working. And then she adds brightly, but we hopped into a taxi. What happened then? We grabbed lunch, she says. It seemed obvious that Ravioli was a romantic figure of the big exotic life that went on in outside her little limited life of parks and playgrounds, drawn in particular from a nearly perfect. So what happens is she's hearing her mother talk to her friends, and she's almost like repeating like a minor bird, because all of her mom's discussions on the phone are, oh, I know, I tried to make a date with Meg, but I couldn't find her. I left a message on her machine. Then I bumped into Emily after the meeting I had in Soho, so we went for coffee, and then she had a run, and that by that time, Meg had reached me on my cell phone, and that's what she's hearing in the house. So there she is playing it out. She can't get together with her playmate. Too busy. So he gets worried that Ravioli may be some sign of trauma, some loneliness in her life. Olivia's life is reflected in this imaginary form. It seems odd to have an imaginary playmate who's always too busy to play with you. So they take her to, you know, a psychologist who's a friend of theirs, and they learn to live happily. She said she seems fine with Charlie Ravioli. And all of a sudden, Laurie appears. Laurie is suddenly in her discussions. So they said, she said, I would begin. I talked to Laurie today. She would begin. She says, Ravioli is busy. But I spoke to Laurie, who's his secretary. She's a bright-toned person, but Ravioli was at a meeting, so she got Laurie. And Laurie now says he's too busy. So it's an interesting story. Those of you who have kids and what we pick up from each other. Perhaps the earth can teach us, with all the natural disasters, the earth continues its journey. The earth is fine. We're not. After a period of time, the cycle of rejuvenation will continue, move on, continually alive, living and dying. So we need to just be aware of what we're up to, treat ourselves wisely, and try to discover the true source of satisfaction. Buddha said, all we have to know is what you are. All you have to know is what you are. He said, be a lamp unto yourself. Give life to the Buddha. Now I'll count to 12. And you keep quiet, and I will go. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JIZOPROJECT.